Hi, I'm back. My name is Mariantina Gotsis, and I'm a research assistant professor at Interactive Media and Games at the University of Southern California at the School of Cinematic Arts. I direct the Creative Media and Behavioral Health Center, which is an organized research unit between the cinema school and the medical school. And we develop games, virtual reality, social media interventions for education, new therapies, new treatments, and assessment tools. My background is in arts and engineering, and I've had an interest in health, medicine, neuroscience for a very long time. And I started pursuing this work around 2007, and we started the center in 2010 and have built really great collaborations within the School of Cinematic Arts, across the university, and all over the United States and internationally in a few locations also. So it's been a really great experience, and we now also have a new degree emphasis in health and games and media arts, health and games. So we're very excited about that. So the center develops new products that are focused on variety of topics. So some things might be pressing, urgent public health challenges such as obesity and exercise, and others might be very more rare things, or I guess things that people don't see in the news all the time. So, for example, exercise specific to people with spinal cord injury, a little more specialized, and we look at topics that come to us from other people. So a lot of clinicians and researchers come to us with a problem, and we work together in teams to figure out how we could potentially solve this problem. And sometimes we're curious about things, and we might reach out to people. That happens more for students that we mentor because they have a particular interest in an area. And so we help match them with experts in science and medicine to provide guidance and mentoring for them throughout their project. So we've worked on various topics. We've worked on obesity, autism, eye disease, early childhood neuroscience, so developmental neuroscience, arm amputation, hearing disorders, anxiety, depression, traumatic brain injury. So, I don't claim to be an expert in all these things, but I know some really great experts in those things, and I've had the pleasure of working with them. And we have a very non-technological approach to solving problems in that we look at how the problem needs to get solved, and then we sort of choose what form and technology to go with. So we might develop a board game which doesn't have any technology, but it's still an entertainment experience and it's a game. Or we might think about very high-tech virtual reality approach to solve something, and everything in between. So it really depends on how we need to reach people, and so how soon. So that's really how we think about the technology that we're going to choose. And I work with students and faculty of all ages, and I include both students and faculty in that because it's really important to have teams that have both diversity in the kinds of topics that they explore, and their backgrounds, their training, and how their mind works, but also in their ages. So sometimes I have high school students, sometimes, not very common, but I have undergraduates, graduates, doctoral students, postdocs, junior professors, senior professors, retired professors, all ages. And those teams that have that level of diversity, they really work very well. And they're also fun, and we learn from each other, and you get a perspective that you wouldn't otherwise get. So that's kind of our philosophy behind how we work, is looking at diversity every possible way, and it works really well for solving these kinds of problems. It depends on the project, so it might be as few as 3 or as many as 25. And some projects have overlapping experts, but then some may never work with each other. A lot of projects that I collaborate on that I'm not necessarily the lead on have very large teams that also meet remotely. So sometimes, you know, as many as 25, 30 people working through video conferencing. So a lot of scientists, clinicians, and, you know, researchers, engineers, artists. Especially early in the process when we're trying to teach each other and problem solve, it's almost like doing like a short course, you know. It's like we're all teaching each other and we're trying to narrow down the problem and solution. So they're pretty intensive, but you also learn a lot. And even with our small teams, you know, we might do it that kind of thing for a shorter period of time, but certainly in the beginning, teams can tend to be kind of larger, and then they might get a little smaller and break out. So not everyone meets all the time. So when you switch from research to more prototyping or pre-production, things funnel out a little bit more. And that's pretty natural, because you don't, after you know what you're doing, you just kind of go. And that's how it works. So the Brain Architecture Game was conceived, I believe, around 2009. So we've worked on it for quite some time, but we've just commercially released it. We've released the DIY version of it, and we're also working with a developer and a factory to have a packaged version. And this is it's an educational tabletop game that teaches the science of early childhood without big science words. So it's very accessible. It was initially developed for policymakers, and we discovered that it's really extremely versatile. So it's being used by people teaching parenting classes, early childhood teachers, health professionals in training. I even tested it with prison wardens last year, right? This is a pretty serious playtest. Really a wide range of people. Now we're also doing high school students, and I'll tell you a little bit about the history of it. So I collaborate with the Center on the Developing Child at Harvard University, and they have a National Scientific Council on the Developing Child. They actually work with Brazil quite a bit. And they, together with other collaborators like the Frameworks Institute in Washington, tried to communicate a consensus about the science of early childhood to policymakers, people of influence, from very high level to, you know, everyday people like teachers and parents, what they need to know about the science of early childhood and how it impacts lifelong health. And so they review the literature and put out working papers and videos, things that people should know, what actually works, you know, where also investments should be made, because there's a lot of myths about what works and what doesn't work. And there's money associated with a lot of these decisions, especially with regard to education and healthcare. So, for example, investment in high-quality caregiving is something that really pays off later in life, you know, or family leave, maternity, paternity leave, those kinds of things that seem, you know, maybe not so big because it's just like 6 or 10 weeks or 8 or 12 weeks, depending on which country you're in. They have a huge impact on the brain, because at that age, your brain is developing so many connections and everything matters. You know, it's like that environment and that interaction with your caregivers and in a great low stress environment in terms of toxic stress is really very good for the brain, and it protects you from bad things happening down the line. So the brain develops kind of from the bottom up, and the game gets built from the bottom up. And so we call it the brain architecture game. And you roll a die and you get a base to start with, and that's your genetic lottery. And then you roll the die and you get your social supports, and that's the people that you have around you in those first years of life. And then you get a series of life experience cards. So you build from years 1 to 8. And in the first 5 years of life, you get materials to build, some stronger, some weaker, depending on whether you're getting experiences that result in toxic stress or positive stress. Some things are in between. It depends on what's happened to you, how you're going to deal with that. And then in years 6 and 8, you get weights that get hung from the tallest part of your structure if you get toxic stress. And so your game ends when the structure collapses or when the cards end. And your goal at the beginning is to build the tallest, strongest structure that you can build. And people do this in teams. So it might be 8 to 15 people. It might be 100 people, 200 people in classrooms, workshops, conferences. So you get to look around and see what everyone else is doing. And you're building one brain together. In 4 to 6 people are doing it together. So there's a community feeling to it. There's a lot of conversation. There's a lot of anxiety, as you know, you're worried that this thing is going to fall apart. There's a lot of excitement when you get, you know, good things happen because you know it's working. So you hear cheering in the rooms. You hear like, you know, as people are worried. We've had really fantastic feedback from our evaluations. So as of last year, 12,000 people have played it. And it's been an amazing journey. It started because of one neuroscientist that came to me trying to think about, God, how do we communicate to people in a more engaging way? So this was Pat Levitt from the National Scientific Council on the Developing Child. And then Judy Cameron, another neuroscientist on the council, she saw the first prototype we made and she took it and ran. You know, she just does so much outreach in science, education, and healthcare, and she really needed a tool, and she was really the biggest champion for it, and she helped modify it. And then the Palex Foundation in Canada started using it quite a bit for their work, and they saw the impact, and they very generously supported us to do the development, the production. They've been a partner from the beginning. Because again, they've used it the most very systematically in their province, and they've seen its potential, and you know they've helped us a lot. So, you know, it's been a great journey, and we're still learning. There's additional stuff happening with it that I can't announce, but we're getting there, and there'll be translations posted in the near future. So something analog that might be partially digitized in the future, can't talk about it. So very exciting and great impact for all ages. So adverse childhood experiences early in life, they accumulate. And because there's so much activity in the brain early in life, that wiring, you know, needs to be strong and healthy. Because if it's not, through neglect or abuse, I would say what we call sort of the set points in your brain and your body gets shifted, right? So for example, if you have experienced a lot of abuse early in life, your levels of anxiety are going to be much higher than necessary. So you're going to respond to everything in a very, you know, fearful, jumpy way. And some people might really internalize that, right, and become very withdrawn. Some people might become very aggressive because you just get off balance, right? So too much toxic stress on one side, right, and you see the world through that lens, or neglect. So we don't talk about neglect as much, but neglect also has a very toxic effect on the brain. So because our brain is wired for interaction, and we, you know, we're born sort of waiting for these positive interactions with our environment. That's how we learn, through people and, you know, love and affection and eye contact and conversation and all these sorts of things. And the absence of interaction with caregivers is very stressful to the brain. And so that disconnectedness from social interaction and input results in fewer connections, right? And a wired brain that doesn't have as many, well, I should say a poorly wired brain with fewer connections is really not going to perform very well. So what you see is, you know, children that have experienced a lot of adversity, they will have a lot of problems with their working memory, attention, problems managing their emotions. So they will have what we call deficits in executive function. And, you know, those kinds of things will set them up for not doing so well at school. They will have problems with learning. They will have problems with, you know, attaining their goals later in life. They will have relationship problems, right? So handling people also requires executive function. They will have problems with empathy, potentially, just, you know, understanding social, emotional cues. And the other thing is, you know, all this kind of stress seems to really contribute to a lot of disease and disorders later in life. So heart disease, diabetes, mental health problems, right? All these kinds of things. If you have experienced a lot of early adversity and you don't receive a lot of services to help remedy that later, you're definitely going to have more problems later in life. So that's not to say that everything that happens early determines your path. It just means that you're going to have to work harder and you're going to need a lot more resources. So this is really, you know, a big dilemma in where to make investment, because we spend a lot later in life in everything, in healthcare and education, right? We spend more money when people are sick rather than when they're healthy. We spend more money on our children when they're older than when they're younger. And this actually, it costs. It costs for your body, and it costs for society. So we think that this game helps people understand how this investment early in life really pays off later, but also how that resilience actually is built. And it's not an infinite resource. It is something that, you know, you can definitely compare people between, you know, some that are more resilient versus others, but everyone has a breaking point, and it's different, and it requires work to get you back up on your feet. And the brain is pretty amazing, because there are definitely periods that are sensitive, and there are periods that are, you can't do as much during those periods. And it has the ability to recover from a lot of things, but not on its own, right? It takes a lot of people to help you recover from difficult things, both mentally and physically. And so it's good to think about things in terms of a balance, and not infinite resources, and not from a standpoint of individualism, because that's really mythical. It's very rare that people completely on their own do everything. Usually they've had a very rich social environment and a lot of resources around them, and maybe they don't they don't recognize that, right? Not that they're ungrateful, but they don't necessarily see that, that it was not just them. It was maybe a grandparent or a neighbor or a teacher, or, you know, all every person has an influence on you from when you're born until you die. So that's what we're trying to communicate with this game. For more information on the science of early childhood and how the brain architecture game works, take a look at this video and visit our website.
These ordinary people are building brains. It takes a little bit of skill, a little bit of luck, and a lot of teamwork. As you build a brain, you're going to learn how environments, experiences, and genes act together to shape brain development. Ready? It's the Brain Architecture Game. Before we start playing, let's learn some brain science. To help with that, we'll need a scientist.
Our topic today is the brain. We often think of the brain as just one thing, but really, it's like a lot of little brains all inside one organ. Just like a house with many rooms, each room has a different function. Brain cells are the building material. What happens is that experiences you have cause brain cells to connect together, like a house that's getting wired up. Basic sensory abilities like vision and hearing are the first to get wired up. And these act like a foundation for other abilities to be built on. As you age, the right experiences build new rooms. You learn how to walk and talk, and eventually how to do more complex things like arithmetic and planning and reasoning. These last rooms are still getting wired up in your teens and beyond, and that's great news because it means that parents, teachers, coaches, and all of us who spend time with kids can influence the development of these abilities right into a person's 20s. But it's all built on the foundation that began in the earliest years.
So what's going on inside the brain that causes certain abilities to develop in some people and not in others?
This is where experiences really matter. Genes provide the basic instructions to tell cells to connect to each other, but it's experiences, like all that time spent on peekaboo, learning to read, or just playing together, that cause certain circuits to be wired and strengthened during development. Wiring that's used less does not become as strong, and it gets pruned away. So it's up to caregivers and communities to make sure young people have positive brain-building experiences at all ages of their development. Of course, not all kinds of experiences are helpful. Really bad experiences that are intense, frequent, or prolonged, like violence, ongoing neglect, cause stress that's so serious it can have a toxic effect on brain development. A brain experiencing toxic stress will have weaker architecture, and that can lead to a whole range of problems later in life. Sometimes we have experiences that could turn toxic for the brain or not, depending on who's around to give support. Imagine a tragedy like death of a parent. A child left to grieve without adult support will suffer severe stress that lasts a long time. But if caring adults work with the child to soothe the body's stress response and teach coping skills, the experience won't be toxic for the brain. When caregivers prevent severe stress experiences from turning toxic, scientists call it tolerable stress. So, communities and caregivers are very important, whether they're actively encouraging healthy brain development or working to prevent toxic stress from harming the brain. These interventions are very important for the long-term health and well-being of both individuals and the community as a whole. That last point is what I want you to think about when you play the brain architecture game, because as you'll learn soon enough, brains don't build themselves. It's group work. So get all the help you can and go build some brains.
Okay, newly educated brain experts, are you ready to play? Your goal in the brain architecture game is to build your brain as tall as possible. You want a strong brain too, so it won't collapse under the weight of life's stresses. To play the game, you'll need pipe cleaners, supports, they kind of look like straws, a die, weights, life experience cards, and a life journal. The game starts, as life does, with a roll of the dice. What's your genetic starting point? Roll the die and check your life journal. Then, build the corresponding base. Next, you need to find out the number of social supports you have at birth. Roll the die again and collect that number of supports to use later in the game. Mark the results of both rolls on your life journal. Now that your brain is born, life happens. For each year, you'll draw three life experience cards. Their effect on your brain can be positive, toxic, or tolerable, which determines the materials you have to build with. Each time you draw a card, it's important to keep track of what type of experience it is in your life journal. How do life experiences affect brain architecture? If you draw a positive experience, you'll collect a pipe cleaner and a straw as building materials. Because positive experiences, like learning a new skill, are the building blocks of strong brain architecture. What happens when you draw a toxic stress experience card? It's bad news for your brain, because it weakens architecture. Whenever you draw a toxic stress experience, you get a pipe cleaner, but no straw. Sorry. If you draw a question mark card, you may or may not get a support. Add up your life experiences in the game so far. If you've had more positive than toxic experiences, take a straw with your pipe cleaner. If you've had a pileup of toxic stress, you probably aren't getting the caregiver support you need, so no straw for you. If it's a tie or if this is your first life experience card, roll the die. Even rolls mean positive. Odd rolls mean toxic. As you build your brain, keep in mind a few do's and don'ts. Do use all the materials you've collected in a year before moving on to the next year. Do attach pipe cleaners at the ends. Build closed structures at the end of each year. Don't leave open ends to tie up later. Okay, did you get all that? Positive experiences earn a pipe cleaner and straw. Toxic stress earns just a pipe cleaner. Tolerable experiences turn positive or toxic, depending on the balance of experiences in the game so far. Your brain saw some pretty remarkable changes from birth until the end of year 5. From here, the pace of development slows and the rules change, just as they do in life. Starting in year 6, you can't earn any additional straws. Your base is already built, but your brain is still developing. So now, a positive experience earns just a pipe cleaner, and a toxic stress earns a weight. Attach each weight to the tallest point on your brain. Tolerable stress turns positive or toxic, like before. The game ends when your brain finishes year 8, or collapses, or tips over, whichever comes first. Remember, the goal is to build the strongest, tallest brain you can. Work together, have fun, and once you've finished, talk with your group about what happened to your brain.
So I've always had an interest on resilience and how people are different and how some people are perceived very strong and some people are very weak. And those are, you know, they're not the right words, right? Because, there's context, like when and where and how do people break down and, you know, how do they get back on their feet and all that sort of stuff. And you know, I've experienced a lot of differences between people in my family in terms of our collective strength and our individual strength. And I remember my parents telling me, or I should say my mom, you know, it's the usual mom complaining about me and my brother when we do something differently. It's like, I raised you the same way, you know, why are you so different? And that's kind of the lie that all parents tell you, because, you know, you're not raised the same way. My brother and I are 3 years apart. Our parents were different people. 3 years is a long time between that. our environment was different, you know, our social environment was different, and we're different people, you know, even genetically. So it's some random mix between both of her parents and grandparents. And I think that everyone always perceived me as, you know, stronger and all that sort of stuff, but really it was not necessarily true. And so I think that as I got older and I experienced a lot of very difficult things that happened to me, you know, loss of friends and just, you know, life happens sometimes, very, very difficult things happen. And I found my breaking points and I saw how difficult it is to recover from some of that. I started having a lot more empathy for other people who are going through difficult things. And it's not that I had a, you know, easy childhood, but I always had, you know, an attitude of, yeah, I can get through it, I can get through it. But I also had a much different first 3 years of life than other people. So I was kind of set up to just do it, right? And it's kind of weird, but the time that we were developing the game, I had this really crazy experience where, so I generally do a lot of work with communities and people and volunteering, etc. But sometimes it's the individual stories that really have an impact on you. So I was putting gas in my car at a gas station. And this homeless person came to me and he talked to me for about 20 minutes. And he was, you know, very interesting, but also not very well at all. And we talked and, you know, there's something with the conversation that had an impact on me. And I even blogged about it. And he told me his name and all that. And just a few years later, not very long time, while I was working on this game, I was contacted by his sister who was looking for him. And he had passed away and she was looking for any information about her brother. And I was one of the, you know, last few people who had talked to him. And it was very, very sad because he had a very difficult life and some really bad things had happened to him. And he had been homeless for a very long time, like almost 20 years. And both of them had a very difficult life, but, you know, we sort of compared what were the differences, you know, like, so how is it that she managed to survive? I mean, not doing amazing in terms of financially, right? But she kind of survived, right? And he was roaming the streets. And it really resonated with me, the work that we were doing with the game, because it really had to do with the timing of these early things that happened to them and the cumulative impact of stress and obviously something very different in terms of their genetic ability to handle certain things. But even in large studies, like this ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, we sort of see that there is kind of a limit on how much terrible things you can handle. You know, like there's particular things in terms of abuse and neglect, between 4 and 5 of those things early in life, they really set you up to fail and to also have serious mental and physical health problems. So this concept that you can recover from everything, yeah, not so much, especially when a lot of terrible things happen to you early in life and you have no access to resources and you have a very poor social environment with no one to protect you and take care of you and, you know, all of those kinds of things. So that really, you know, it hit home for me and it helped me understand my family better and families of others. And so, you know, I look at the world very differently now because of that. You know, despite how difficult it has been to actually get this project moving, because there's just so many pieces when you're doing production, when I play it and I see people have that same experience as I do when they reflect on, you know, what it means for them or the people that they provide services for, you know, a lot of health professionals that have burnouts and they feel like nothing they do can really make a difference. And they feel reaffirmed that, no, every little small thing I do can make a difference. It motivates me to, you know, keep going. Maybe it can help prevent a lot of these terrible things that I keep seeing all over, all the terrible things people experience. Even the people that you see doing really well, my father always told me, you know, you never know what someone's personal story is. And the more you scratch, the more you realize that maybe they're not so lucky as you think. And they've tried really, really hard to just stay afloat. So we got to be all a little bit nicer to each other because we don't really know what's happening, right? And sometimes ourselves, we don't really know what we've been through because we disconnect to try to kind of make it. So, and I've seen some of that also with the game where people realize not necessarily how lucky they are, right? But actually how unlucky they are and have more compassion for themselves that they've made it. Because sometimes you just forget that, you know, a lot of stuff happened and it's okay. You know, it's okay to be weak or strong. So as long as you've got people around you, right? So with games that can help you with exercise, I think that there's great potential out there, even though a lot of the studies that look at exercise games, so physical activity type games from Kinect to the Wii to, you know, other kinds of things you can do from the early days of Dance Dance Revolution, people have studied how games can help increase physical activity. And in lab studies, research lab studies where you bring people in and you have them exercise, of course, you can really get their heart rate up and they also enjoy the activity. The problem is that, you know, as humans, we're lazy. People are lazy. We're energy conserving. We've been designed that way, right? To just store sugar, forage, find things that are tasty and safe and just eat them and buckle down and don't do more than necessary sometimes. So, you know, when you have these really great games that do help and they can get your heart rate up and you can have fun with other people, it's hard to get people to use them consistently, right? So, you know, you might do it once, twice, three times, four times. But unless you're self-motivated on your own, it ends up a lot of times being not much different than buying a treadmill or something like that. And so the challenge with games, okay, a treadmill doesn't have narrative, right? But games have narrative. And so I think that getting people to use games for physical activity can only be solved by creating very engaging narratives, things that maintain people's imagination and curiosity and a reason to come back, right? And that has to go beyond just counting points. Some people are very motivated by numbers, but a lot of people are not. They need to be motivated by other things. So story or social interaction, all that sort of stuff. People that go to group classes very consistently, a lot of them go because they love being around people and exercising with people. And so we have to look at the social aspects of gaming and develop designs, game mechanics, and narrative that looks at involving more people in deeper, interesting, meaningful ways. Because otherwise, it's going to be like buying something that's an exercise game will be even less useful than a treadmill, because treadmills, you can at least hang your clothes on it, you know, after you got it. They become very useful for that, apparently. So whereas, you know, the game, it's just going to be another file on your computer or sitting on your console, so taking up hard drive space. So that's a big challenge for game designers. You know, the the biomechanics of games, yes, you can get people moving, and you can even do that safely if you work with a team that understands what safe levels of exercise are. You can have tremendous impact. We've had some really great experiences with that. But good stories that are appropriate for that kind of thing, and great game mechanics, and feedback and mechanisms for rewards that keep people coming back, that's still kind of not solved, right? So I put that challenge out there for all game designers. And then with regard to mental health, there's just so many ways that games can help. But first, the great thing that has happened in the last few years because of serious games is that people are disclosing all sorts of issues, right? From anxiety to depression, to, you know, trauma, but also things that have to do with their identity. So queer games right now are a great way for people to feel included, to reduce stigma in the community, to help people understand what it's like to be different. And so any sort of perception of difference can completely be leveled through games, you know, from disability to gender to ethnicity, all these sorts of things. Because there's so many different kinds of game creators these days, there's such diversity in the kinds of topics that they explore. And the more diversity in these topics and themes exists, the greater the potential for reducing stigma is. And that's a really fantastic thing to see. So we're reaching this new era of, you know, social activism, and also curiosity, right? And people, you know, looking at other people's stuff, and you can do it sort of safely, you know, just like watching a movie. Like, you can really get into someone else's skin through a game and understand what it feels like to be different, and that's really great. Now, the other thing that you can do, because games can be used long term, you can teach people things, right? So you can teach them how to deal with difficult things, from having difficult conversations or better conversations to feeling differently, right? You can teach people over a period of time how to change the way they think and feel about something. So certainly with regard to your emotions, great games are a really great way to change how you feel. So for anxiety and depression, and also a lot of trauma, they're very, very useful. And because now they're merging so much with virtual reality, and virtual reality has such great evidence behind it for use in trauma and mood disorders, and even addiction, it's a really great era for creating games for that purpose. So exposure therapy, like slow, gradual exposure in a controlled, safe environment to things that scare you, for example, has great evidence behind it in terms of helping people cope with those issues. And what better than a game, right? Slow way into something, get to learn how to use it, you can interact with people, and then level up, right? Level up whatever it is that you're trying to tackle. So I see very exciting products in that area. And the virtual reality aspect of it is fantastic, because virtual reality is a very physiologically immersive medium, because it takes over your ocular vestibular system, right? Your eyes, your ears, your balance, and you're in it. You know, you really feel like you're in it. And when you're in it, you can let go of, you know, a bit of who you were trying to be and hold on to at that moment, and just have an experience that's different, and really kind of work through something very difficult or enjoy something very, very deeply. It's also very useful for pain management, right? For people who experience chronic pain. And because it really occupies such a big part of your brain. And you can help people reintegrate pain into something positive versus something negative that's just, you know, really causing them great level of anxiety and depression. So there's just so many areas you can go to with it in the future. And I feel also that we're expanding the age groups, you know, as gamers are getting older and as older people have been raised with technology, are much more willing to try stuff. I think that the barriers of entry for games in VR have really been lowered. There's this couple of great videos on the internet about grandmothers wearing Oculus Rifts. I love those videos because we have this conception of older people as not being hip or interested in trying technology. And I have the complete opposite experience. You know, I see my grandmother who's 95. The moment my mom put a tablet in front of her with YouTube videos, she was doing her exercises, watching those videos. Yeah, no one had to explain to her the internet. She didn't care. She had a video in front of her. And, you know, my mom and her sister, they have the latest touch screen smartphone, and they're on Facebook. My mom loves traveling on the internet with QuickTime VR videos. She doesn't need to know how it works. It works, and she's there, and, you know, she loves it. And so we have to get past this, you know, concept of age, really, and think about the kinds of things that people want to do. And they're emotionally driven, and they're also driven by curiosity and the imagination, and, you know, don't worry about this other stuff so much. So I see this, you know, great leveling of design where you can now produce things for the mobile platform, for virtual reality, for the computer, all these kinds of things, and just focus on that emotional experience and that user experience that you're delivering, and don't worry so much about, you know, what are people going to be able to use it. I mean, obviously there's a lot of issues with the operating system and the user interface and all that. But if you really focus on what you're trying to get people to experience, you can design backwards from that. And I think that we've had it wrong for quite some time, where we design something with a lot of capacity, but not so much user experience. And then it becomes very difficult for people to use it. I remember before touchscreen computers and smartphones and all that, my grandfather, who lived to be 97, he loved pictures. So I took him my laptop at some point, and I was showing him travel pictures. And the first thing he did when he saw my laptop and pictures, he tried to touch the screen and scroll on the screen. He'd never seen a computer or a cell phone in his life. And this was a while ago. And I thought, you know, how amazing, right, that he had this expectation of how the technology is supposed to work before we even built it. And, you know, and it's what he wanted to do. He just wanted to see the next picture. For him, he just reached out and touched the screen because he expected to be able to touch the screen. Because he can touch pictures, why not touch the screen? So I love working with older people and children because they sort of teach you how you're supposed to function in the world. And it's pretty amazing. You just kind of forget as an adult. You're so restricted in what you're supposed to do. And, you know, kids and older people, they don't care. They either don't know yet they're supposed to be a certain way, or they're too old to care. So they just are going to be the way that they want to be. So it's great. Games for kids and older adults is the best, most rewarding work that you'll ever do. So we have a new emphasis in our Masters of Fine Arts in Interactive Media. We have an emphasis in games and health, and that is a 3-year program. and it's a cohort-based program. So we take a group of people, and they work together for 3 years. They take classes together, and they can specialize if they want in games and health. So that's one of the new options we offer. But we also have a new 2-year program, an MA in cinematic arts, with emphasis in media arts, games, and health. And that's meant to attract a wider audience from people with undergrad in science or education or physical therapy or engineering, who knows, or the arts, who want to learn in a more applied way how they can use games, social media, virtual reality, to solve a wide range of problems in public health, neuroscience, medicine. And we're looking at people and talent. So come join us. So thank you for watching my video. If you have any questions, I will be on the chat, and I look forward to talking to you. And σας ευχαριστώ πάρα πολύ. Thank you very much.